Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cuska, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clements, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their community dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Bucks basketball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clements with sports. Short turnaround. The Bucks host the Atlanta Hawks tonight. The Bucks coming off a 127-107 win over the Pistons last night in Detroit. Head coach Doc Rivers on their seventh win in a row.
The more we attack the paint, the more open shots we're going to get. Detroit is a help basketball team like every team is. And our guys just found the open man.
College Hoops, number 5th ranked Marquette is at Iowa State tonight. On Saturday, they'll host Wisconsin. The Badgers losing to Michigan, 67-64, their first loss of the season. Head coach Greg Gard.
Credit to Michigan. They banked on us not being able to bang in some threes and did a good job of gumming up the paint and made it hard in terms of that regard. And we're able to get enough offense going to get past us.
NFL, the Packers. Matt LaFleur asked if Jair Alexander will be able to play Thursday night against the Lions despite his knee injury.
We'll see. I mean, I have no idea. I'm not a doctor.
That's Matt LaFleur with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Matt Nair on air. This shouldn't be a thing.
Michigan man leads lawnmower chase. I'll stop, says the suspect. Instead, he reaches under the seat and pulls out a gun.
Shoots himself in the hand.
The deputy has his taser trained on him, and yes, he tased him.
I'm not advocating him for crime, but boost something that goes faster than cop on foot.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Thanks for listening. Your spot for local sports coverage is Civic Media.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. I'm going to spend the first couple minutes sharing my frustration. I put out on social media the other day that I'm struggling with the reality that the person that I love the most, my wife, is going to be in the hands of or at the mercy of some of the worst people. And the response I got back is, you know, what are you talking about? Are you talking about the people who care for her? No. I'm not talking about the people who are going to be around her, the aides that she's going to need, the assistants. No. It's the policymakers. Because I'm coming to the reality that for the last 20 years of doing this kind of work, in the last 35 years of being a political activist and fighting the good fight, I've realized that we've lost. And the reality of how much damage the Republican Party and conservative Democrats have done to the working class. It's a struggle for me. The reality of how much damage Republicans and conservative ideology has done to America, has done to working families like mine, it's kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. And more in particular is, we're not sure where my wife is going to end up in a year. There's a chance she could recover. There's a chance the brain will rewire itself. There's a chance she will lead something of a regular, normal kind of life. But there's also a pretty good chance that she's going to need assistance until the day she dies. And what's been weighing on me is everyone has been giving advice, and thank you for everyone who's been sharing their stories and sharing their thoughts. But a lot of people are like, well, you know, Medicaid, you know, they have, you know, the ability to have long-term help, and you're going to be okay because there's a safety net. There's this belief that there is a safety net, except I live in Pennsylvania, where in 2010, this state, this Commonwealth, elected a Republican governor and a Republican House and Senate. A guy named Tom Corbett was that guy. And immediately they pursued the agenda. They pursued their wet dream fantasy of punishing the poor and working class while enriching the very wealthy. And one of the things they did is they changed that Medicaid thing that used to care for people as that bottom line safety net. They threw in a bunch of asset testing, you know, not just with the Medicaid, but with food stamps and everything else, to where you couldn't have, I think it was like $8,000 worth of assets to get any help whatsoever. And look, you know, most people are driving around in vehicles that are much more expensive than $8,000. So the vast majority of people are precluded, or you have to sell everything and get to the point of being indigent. And look, you know, as a working class guy, if I didn't know any better, if I weren't in the streets fighting these battles year for the past 35 years, it could be easy to take the red hat view that, well, you know, the government is terrible, the government's broken, and, you know, I get screwed while name the other group gets whatever they want. And I've heard this frame, you know, the immigrants, they'd get long-term care. No, they wouldn't. The immigrants, if they fell and broke their leg, you know, we'd fix it. Yeah, and if one of our citizens fell and broke their legs, we should fix that too. So for me, the reality is the right has done a masterful job of telling us how bad the system that they set up is working. They've privatized most of our functions. They've sold us on the idea that corporate America and you know, doing the functions of government is the best way to go, that government is bad, while pushing corporate policies down our throat through our government. And understand, it's going to get much worse. We will privatize, not by choice in my view, we will privatize Medicare in this country very, very soon. Completely. We're almost there. And this is where my problem with Democrats has been. When Republicans do the horrible stuff they do, and they do, when Democrats get power back, they don't completely undo it. And it's been one of those things that just is curious to me. And I keep coming back to, I understand the anger. I feel the anger. But the anger is always being misplaced amongst us. When the reality is, it's these corporate lobbyists, it's these big moneyed interests, it's the hedge funds, it's our corporate masters who have created these systems that put us, well, at each other's throats. And it's a Hunger Games. You know, we're fighting each other in a Hunger Games kind of scenario. So the next 4 years, I do believe, are going to be horrible. I think they're going to be chaotic. I think we're going to see a lot of things stolen from us. I think lives are going to get worse. I think suffering is going to be apparent. But as I've been saying, out of their savagery, comes our suffering and hopefully the solutions. And that through our government, we once again do the things collectively that we can't do individually, such as provide a safety net for people in their worst hours. This is the kind of stuff a civil society, a reasonable society, does. We want to help each other without saying, well, you got something that I didn't, so you shouldn't get it. Instead, we say, well, if you need it and I need it, we should both get it. Just my thoughts. I want to hear yours, though. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And as I said, thank you for everyone who has commented and sent words of encouragement. I really appreciate it. We'll take a quick break. Right back.
We'll be right back. We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So picking up on this frame of it's always the government's fault. Now, I point to a story with Dave Ramsey, the financial guru, the financial radio guru. Not a huge fan, to be honest, but I think on this it's an interesting leaping off point, because Dave Ramsey talking about Medicare and how difficult it is to go through all of the obstacles and around all of the obstacles to get to just what seniors want, and that is the security of health in their final years. He asked the question, why is this so dang complicated? Why is it so dang confusing? And he says, his quote is, well, it was created by the government, so that might be your first clue. The second, he says, is just a lot to understand. And yeah, maybe it is a lot to understand, but should it be? And here to share some thoughts on, well, this idea that it's the government's fault. I've asked my good friend Alex Lawson to come share some thoughts. He's the executive director over at Social Security Works, socialsecurityworks.org, their website. Alex, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure, Rick.
So walk me through some of this, because you got somebody like Dave Ramsey who's talking about retirement. Medicare is a huge thing for many people when they get to retirement age. I know a lot of people my age and a little bit older are going, hey, if you lowered that Medicare age, we could retire today. But why is it so dang complicated? Is it the government's fault? Is it the evil government?
It's a great question. Even in that Dave Ramsey piece, he gets to the answer. So first off, it is really complicated. Anyone who's gone through the process knows that you are immediately faced with this maze that is impossible to get through. There's not enough information to make the best choices. But in that Dave Ramsey piece, he gets there. The problem isn't the government. The problem is that private corporations, primarily United Health, the largest insurance corporation in the country, have wormed their way into the system in the so-called Medicare Advantage system, and they purposefully make it as complex as possible. And then, in the Medicare prescription drug benefit, it was the pharmaceutical corporations that made it as complicated as possible. Now, I just want to say, in other countries, literally every other peer nation of ours, of the United States, it's super simple. You get sick, you get the care you need, full stop. That's it. That's what happens.
Yeah.
It's not complicated. The only complicated thing is how do you provide healthcare while also enriching these insurance and pharmaceutical corporations. That's where the complexity comes in. If we were to eliminate the pharmaceutical corporations and the insurance corporations from this system, it would be as simple as anything, right? The government has nothing to do with the doctors, the facilities, the nurses. In these systems, all the government does is just pays the bill at the end of the day. But right now, what the government does in too many cases in privatized Medicare, they pay a middleman. So it's still the government ending up paying, right? And meaning the taxpayers. We pay into the system in Medicare. It's in contributions and through our tax dollars. But in privatized Medicare, The government still pays. They just hand it to an insurance company first. And then that insurance company can delay care, deny care, tell you what doctor to go to. In traditional Medicare or original Medicare, you can go to any doctor.
Yeah.
And there's no one who says delay or deny, because the choice and the decisions are between the patient and their provider, their doctor. That's the way it should be. That's simple. So the idea of where does the complexity come in? The answer is simple. It's in the need to make buckets full of gold for Wall Street. That's where the complexity comes in. It's how do you provide healthcare and make a handful of people richer than, you know, anyone can even conceive. And the answer, just to say, is by denying care,
yeah.
Right? It's not profitable to provide healthcare. It's profitable to deny healthcare. That's why it's so hard and frustrating. I mean, think of how much time you've spent on the phone arguing with some faceless bureaucrat. The bureaucrats aren't from the government. They're from the insurance company. You know, Lena Khan, I think, had the great rephrasing of the Ronald Reagan quote. The scariest words to hear are, I'm from your insurance company and I'm going to need a prior authorization for that. Millions of people understand that.
Yeah.
The problem is the corporations.
So this you said a phrase that I'm so sick of hearing, and it's, you know, the best choices. This idea that we're making a choice, that we have a choice, and that if we're smart enough and if, you know, we're going to be able to tailor a plan that's just right for us. And I'm going, I just want a plan that's going to pay for it. If I'm laying on the ground having a heart attack, I don't want to be speed dialing to find out which hospital has a coupon this month. I don't want to be on in a situation where I now have to weigh where I'm going. I want to get the best care I can get when I need it, where I need it, and how I need it, and not have to worry about, you know, did I make the right choice?
And not only that, Rick, yes to everything you just said, but also choice relies on information. And if you are strategically not given the information you need to make an informed choice, which is what the case is with privatized Medicare and insurance-based healthcare in general, then you have zero choice in a system that makes sense, a system that provides healthcare, where you get sick and then you get the care that you need. That's where you have a choice. You can actually choose between doctors. You could do research. If you did have heart issues, you could do research. Who is the best doctor in your area? You could make a choice. Right now, you can't make that choice at all. You could try, but then you'd have to run it by a third person, right? This dude in a $5,000 suit who says yes or no to your choices. And he says, here, you're going to go here. Now, when they say, oh, okay, but you can choose your insurance, can you? Because I'll tell you one thing that they never really remind you of, and rhetorical question, Rick, but how many major insurance corporations were there 20 years ago, right? A few dozen, right? Yeah. How about a decade ago? A dozen. How about 5 years ago? Four. How about today? We're down to basically United Healthcare controls the whole thing. So it's a lie. There's no choice at all. They market an incredible amount of plans, but unless you know exactly how the whole system works, you're not gonna be able to make a choice. And let me rephrase that. I do know, I this is what I do for a living, and I can tell you, even me, I can't tell you if a plan is gonna be right for you because they don't give you the information. If it said, the delays and denial rates on this plan are 47%, and the delays and the denial rates on this plan are 2%, you know, you would be like, oh, well, that's a meaningful metric. And right. Then they'd be like, oh, and the delays and denials on traditional Medicare are 0%. You'd be like, oh,
no brainer.
I'm going to go, right? But they don't say that. They just keep saying, make the choice that's best for you. And you're like, that's false. You can't make a choice if you don't have the information, and you really are getting at an important thing. And I think you're making this point, but let me make it straightforward. it also makes it seem like you made the mistake, right? Like if something goes wrong and you get faced with a big bill, like, oh, well, you better have made a better choice. It puts, and this is the American, this is like what corporations love to do. They try to make a systemic failure about an individual's choice, especially when that individual doesn't actually have a meaningful choice to make. The structural failures are what are driving the fact that the United States, we spend the most on healthcare of any advanced economy and have the lowest life expectancy and the worst health outcomes for the median person. If you're rich in this country, you can get phenomenal healthcare. And that's how we know that the system is rigged. It's not broken,
right.
It's rigged. Because if you're rich anywhere in the world, you might even fly to the United States to get world-class healthcare because we have it here. It's just not for everybody. It's only for rich people. So that's not a healthcare system. That's a rich care system.
No, it's an excellent point. But at least, you know, with the choice plans, you get tennis shoes. You get a gym membership. You get, you know, maybe a couple of dollars back. You know, if you're healthy enough, if you made the right choice, and this is the part that gets me, because we're moving to completely privatize Medicare, and I think that's going to happen in the next 4 years. I think the Trump administration will go full steam ahead. I think Doge Boy and his clan will want to completely privatize not just Social Security, but or not just Medicare, but Social Security as well. And all those little sweeteners, once they've fully privatized it, those are going to go away too.
Yeah, and also in many cases they don't exist in the first place, right? It's always the read the fine print. You're absolutely correct, unfortunately, that we're going to do everything that we can, Rick, as you know. We will be fighting tooth and nail against all of the privatization. But there is so much that Donald Trump can do through executive action with Dr. Oz ahead of CMS. And I will say, don't confuse Dr. Oz with some of the other clowns that have been proposed. He is clownish. He plays one on TV. But under that is a very cold, sharp, corporate health executive. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he's going to be able to do a lot of it. And that is hand our healthcare system over more fully to United Health. And then let me point this out, because what they will do, they'll actually want to leave some form of, you know, traditional original Medicare.
Sure.
For sick people.
Certainly. And I say this all the time. You know, what a system that we have in this country where the elderly and the poor and the sick and for, you know, disabled are on government programs. But us healthy people, we get this privatized stuff. And if you're the insurance company, that's the greatest situation you can have, where you get to cherry pick who you want and let the government pick up the costly folks. It's quite remarkable. It's quite a gig they've got.
It is. That's why I say it's not a broken system. It's a rigged system. And I'm a nerd, so bear with me or reel me in. But you used one side, cherry picking. It's totally true. What you do is you try to sell healthcare to people who don't need it, right? Super profitable. So then you collect the premiums, but they never need the care. So the joke was with Medicare Advantage, you put the Medicare Advantage sign up on the fifth floor. So you had to go up five flights of stairs to sign up for Medicare Advantage. It's not a joke. They literally did that. It works. That's for selecting healthy people. But now they just let the robots do that with big data, right? They track everything. They know everything. And they're able to really market these products to healthy people. But I want to say the other side too, it's called lemon dropping, which is if they do find people who are sick accidentally, and they accidentally are supposed to cover somebody who needs care, what they try to do is lemon drop them, which means push them off of their rolls. And there's a few ways you do this. They start making it much more difficult. The older you get, you start getting sort of pushed out through bureaucratic inefficiencies. Called bureaucratic disentitlement. They make it more and more difficult to keep signing up for one plan. And then during open enrollment, they push you to another. But the one that I really want people to face is that the easiest way for the insurance companies to lemon drop is to kill people, right? So that's why they delay and deny. You know who they delay and deny the most? Those who need care the most.
Right.
Why? Because if you delay needed care on someone who otherwise would cost a bunch of money, they'll die in the meantime. And then the company saves money. And you can say that's evil because it is, but you also have to remember that by the books, these companies have a fiduciary obligation to make as much money as possible, which is why we can't reform this rigged system. We need to replace the rigged system. If you leave any of this in place the way it is right now, it will always result right back here. Rural hospitals across this country just closing, rural hospital after rural hospital, as it's not profitable to provide healthcare in rural areas. I'll try to mosey out the end of the interview on a more positive note. We will be fighting, and we will, I think it'll be a long defeat as things are privatized. But just remember that out of chaos and carnage is actually where a lot of policy innovations or just creations came from.
Yep.
The NHS in England, their healthcare system, a crown jewel of the world, that was formed because the Nazis destroyed England, right? It wasn't out of everyone got together and were like, hey, let's do a great thing. It was out of desperate need. Medicare was created in the 60s. You know, it wasn't because LBJ and got suddenly everybody on board and was like, hey, let's do this. They were responding to the crisis of insurance companies lemon dropping everybody over the age of 65. So no one could get insurance if you were older. One in three seniors lived in poverty. Out of that chaos came Medicare. Social Security was born of the Great Depression, right? It didn't come together because everybody joined hands and saying kumbaya. It was, everything was totally terrible. One in two seniors lived in poverty, 50%. And out of that came Social Security. So we will fight to protect every gain that we have. We will fight to prevent a single person from losing their healthcare. But as the billionaire wrecking crew does their wreckage, just remember their system cannot work. And in the face of that onslaught, you know, that's where solidarity comes together. And that's where my hope is. People are going to get hurt. Yeah. It is going to be terrible. I do not look at this as a silver lining good thing. I am just saying, I know that in the face of this, that's where solidarity will blossom. And I know that we'll build a future where the system is, you get sick, you get the care you need, full stop, because every other country has done it. So I know we can as well.
Yeah. No, as I've been saying, look, the solutions will come out of the savagery and the suffering from their savagery. It's just, we're going to have to go, unfortunately. We are going to have to go through this. And you would think as rational thinking creatures that we would not have to go through this kind of pain and suffering and chaos to get to a better outcome. But it seems history has shown us we only unite or come together in times of crisis.
Yeah, and I wish as well that, you know, that wasn't the case. But it too often is. A lot of it, I call it, and it's not my term, you can look it up, but it's the decency trap. And it's sort of a like bittersweet, wonderful, but terrible thing.
Yeah.
It's because, you know this, Rick, if you go across the country, the vast majority of people are decent people. They're just decent, hardworking people who are living in a system that they didn't create. They just find themselves in it. And when I go out there and I say, look, these insurance corporations, they're going to kill you for profit. A decent person can't find that in their own heart. So they're like, I don't think that's actually how the system works until they're confronted with it directly. And yeah. Then they're like, my God, This is an immoral system. They will kill us for profit. And when people are faced with that, you know, unavoidable truth, that's when we will find the will to act. And the path, we will have laid the groundwork to get the groundwork to get where we're going again, which is, and it, I just want to state it, it's so easy. You get sick, you get the care you need, full stop. That's full stop. It.
Yep. I'm right there with you. Alex, as always, great stuff. I appreciate the time. I know we will be speaking a lot over the next 4 years. Appreciate the time.
As always, Rick, thanks.
Our good friend Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works. Make sure you check out their website, socialsecurityworks.org. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You got any of these stories? A loved one of yours? Maybe you had to go through the denial process in the hope you die? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
Packers, Badgers, Bucks, and Brewers. Find your favorite team over the air on Civic Media.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media is your spot for sports. From updates on your favorite teams, live broadcasts of the Packers, Badgers, Brewers, and Bucks, and local sports coverage in your community, we've got everything you need. Find a station near you at civicmedia.us or download the free app today. We'll have more news and talk coming up here on Civic Media's stream.
The John and Gordy Show.
Thanks, Joe, for giving us a call this morning.
I'm really not concerned about a trans woman being in the bathroom. Mike Johnson puts this through, right? But then he says the person who's in charge of enforcing this will be the sergeant at arms. You weenie. You absolute weenie. You put this through and then you dump the enforcement on somebody else. Are you kidding? Are we really spending time on this?
Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on 92.7 WMDX and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, one of the things that I saw over the weekend that grabbed my attention, made me laugh kind of. As you know, Trump is talking about massive tariffs on Canada and Mexico, whom we've got a free trade agreement with. And there've been a big powwow at Mag-a-Lago, but now things are starting to trickle out, you know, about the meeting with Justin Trudeau, and I want to believe it's a joke. I want to believe it's something that, you know, was just kind of an off the cuff, but I don't know. Donald Trump suggesting that maybe Canada become the 51st state, and that Trudeau could be governor, although prime minister is a more interesting title. Yeah, this is what we're going to get for four more years. But the question is, blowing up all our trade deals, is this a good thing? Will this be short-term pain, long-term gain? Will we reshore manufacturing by doing this? Will it make us better? And here to share some thoughts on this whole tense moment, especially as China is reacting to our overtures as well. I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you.
So what do you think? I mean, well, let's start with the 51st state thing, outside of the reality that it would be really hard. It would be really hard for Canada to become a state, even though Trump, I truly believe he thinks it would be just a stroke of a pen. But any chances Canada becomes the 51st state?
No. Let's dismiss that right away. So not a chance. And it reminds me a little bit of the musings about whether we ought to buy Greenland, right?
I forgot about that. From
Denmark. He is an acquisitionist, right? So it's probably not the last time we're going to hear about picking up a territory here or there. But, you know, at the heart of this, you know, and the thing that interested me is that, you know, he did this whatever Truth Social post I want to say it was like the Monday before Thanksgiving, saying, you know, he's going to do the 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada because of fentanyl and immigration, and maybe trade a little bit, and then 10% on China for the same reason. And it got me thinking about, well, you know, this is all very haphazard, and, you know, doing something through social media is not the best way to make policy. But it does point to a piece of leverage that the United States has that we're not willing to utilize enough, and that we haven't been able to utilize enough. And that's the access to our market, right? Because we buy 20% of the world's goods and services. We're only 5% of the world's population. We're all-star consumers. And using that market power as leverage is actually something I support, and I imagine you do.
Absolutely.
As well, for the right reasons. And so, and look, I don't know what the outcome of all of this is going to be, other than I don't think Canada is going to become our 51st state, but it got, you know, the president of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, on the phone with Trump to talk about this. It got Justin Trudeau to Florida to have dinner with the president to talk about this, to have the conversations. And, you know, we've seen the script before, that there'll be an announcement that Mexico's agreed to do this, Canada's agreed to do that, and the threat of tariffs is abated somewhat until a new kind of irritant comes up.
Right.
But I think, you know, I don't want one of the messages to get lost here, which is that we should not be afraid to use our market power and access to our market as leverage to achieve goals. I think that's something that is very important to understand, and that no matter if you're progressive, conservative, you don't care about an ideology, it's something that we have underutilized in the past. And that's, so from that perspective, I'm glad that there's a willingness to do that.
Sure, but my problem is, and again, I'm gonna probably say this an awful lot over the next 4 years. We saw what happened during the first 4 years. So used the leverage that you're talking about, but used it very poorly, I would argue. And there's a point, I fear, and maybe you've got a thought on this, that eventually you keep pushing, that it just becomes either they don't take you seriously, or eventually they organize everyone against you. And I find either to be kind of a problem.
Well, that's right. And I think that's the important thing, is that you got to use that leverage with strategy to achieve something tangible. And the record on that is, I would say, mixed at best, right? So you had a China deal in the first Trump administration, and there had been a lot of tariffs that were put into place on Chinese products. But Trump stopped that, sat down at the table with the Chinese. They made a deal where China would buy, you know, $200 billion worth of U.S. goods and services. 70% of that never materialized, and there was no consequence, right? There was no consequence to that at all. And with respect to Mexico, there was a leverage to renegotiate NAFTA, which was long overdue. Right. That we needed to reform or get rid of it. And there were some reforms made. I think we could have gone farther. There were some reforms made, and it's underperformed, though. And so that's something that I'm looking over the next 2 years or so that will come up again, and we'll see what happens there. But Rick, you are also absolutely right in pointing out that, you know, other countries know this playbook now. They kind of know the plays that he's going to run, and they know how to do that, as long as you can say there's some mutual, you know, there's some outcome that's beneficial to the United States.
See, I'm gonna stop you there. I don't think it's beneficial to the United States. This is where,
well,
again,
they say is beneficial to the United States.
Again,
sorry.
I come back to beneficial to Donald Trump. But yeah, not necessarily absolutely. To us. And this is maybe it's just I remember too vividly those 4 years. But this is the concern here.
Well, and rightfully so. Okay. And that's what that's what I mean, is that there is I think there is the ability to make some progress on some issues. And again, the USMCA, which is the free trade agreement we have now with Mexico and Canada, it is worlds better than NAFTA was. Was it good enough? No. But and was it, you know, have we made a little bit of progress? Yeah, but it's also, you know, it turned kind of Mexico into a backdoor for goods coming from China. And so the question is, yeah, is there a big signing ceremony and we end up with something that Trump says I'm the best negotiator ever, but turns out to not be so great?
Yeah.
Or do we get something real?
No, and this is where I'm sure a lot of my friends and my listeners and people who are going to go, but you're supposed to not be in favor of Donald Trump. This is where they're going to be mad at me, because look, I've said we should be blowing up our free trade agreements that have been horribly detrimental to our economy and to our workers for decades now. I've been saying we should be blowing this up anyway. But there just has to be a plan. There has to be a point. There has to be a strategy. There has to be a way of reshoring manufacturing, investing and filling those gaps and doing those things so the short-term pain doesn't fall where we know it always does, and that is on the working poor and on the working class of this country, while the Elon Musks, our co-president, and the rest of the billionaire class figure out how to pocket off of the reshoring like they did on the outsourcing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right about that, because the point of trade policy, and again, tariffs are a legitimate tool, is not to just shift trade flows from one place to another. I mean, there may be an advantage to that. Say we want to deleverage out of China just because we don't want to enrich the Chinese Communist Party, or that we think that they're going to hold some goods hostage that we need. Right. OK, that's a legitimate reason. But I'd like to see that production, as much of it as possible, come back to the United States, you know, so that we have more manufacturing here.
Yeah.
And that is not going to happen exactly without the stuff that you said, without those investments, without the industrial policy, without the investment in workers, without all of that. And that is something that Trump did not do, but Joe Biden did, because otherwise you just get a rising trade deficit with Vietnam, which is exactly what we have right now. And that's, you know, I guess it's good on the one hand that you're shifting production out of China, but it's still not manufacturing coming back to the United States. And that's what I want to see more of. I'm sure that's what you want to see more of. And to make sure that those jobs are good jobs as well.
Yeah, not slave labor jobs. Now, you brought up the trade deficit, which we've been talking about for years. The U.S. has a massive trade deficit with the rest of the world, and most likely more China and the OPEC nations than others. But Trump hit on the fact that Canada has a $100 billion a year trade surplus, which in the grand scheme of our trade deficit, is that really a big deal?
Well, I guess yes and no. And here's the thing about Canada, you know, a big chunk of that trade deficit is oil.
Yeah,
is caught up in the oil price, right? And so, I don't think any of his people are going to want oil cutbacks from China.
So we're not getting that bucket gallon gas on January 21st
from Canada. They're not going to want that, right? You know, and we're, you know, honestly, we're pumping as much as we can here in the United States. I mean, I suppose you can top it off somehow, but that's certainly something that Biden and Harris didn't lift up, is that we're like producing more oil and gas in the United States than we ever have in our history by a lot.
Yeah, but right? if you ask the redhead crowd, I got guys who believe we've stopped pumping oil.
That's not happening.
We've cut it off because of course of the XL pipeline, and I'm told we're gonna fire that baby back up. So who knows? But the question I wanted to get to is, you know, it's one thing to strong arm our quote unquote trading partners, allies like Canada and Mexico. It's a whole nother thing to be trying to strong arm China, because as we're now finding out, a lot of critical minerals that we needed, China's holding back. And since during the Trump years, we left a massive void in international leadership, a lot of what China has done masterfully, to their credit, you know, they're the smart ones, they got into Africa and took up a lot of places that have the minerals that the world mm-hmm. needs because we left that void.
Yeah. Africa, Asia, South America, Central America, you name it. They're there because the United States is not. And we're trying to rebuild some of these partnerships. And the Biden administration has done some of that. And to its great credit, without giving away access to our market, like that's the way that it was done before. We'll give you a free trade deal and you'll give us that, right? And who loses in that? Our workers, absolutely. Right? And so Biden had done that. You're right. I mean, I don't know that that's in Trump's DNA to do that approach. And you know, Biden got like the EU to toughen up on China quite a bit. I mean, still not as tough as we are, but way tougher than they had been. But I want to return to North America for a minute because I think we ought to work stuff out with Canada and Mexico. And yeah, there are things that they can do better. But let's remember what gives us such a global geostrategic advantage, and that's two oceans and two friendly neighbors, right? And virtually no other place in the world has that.
Right.
No other place in the world has that. That's what we have. Like that is like massive. And you know, the oceans are great, and the fact that Canada and Mexico are friendly is great too. So let's resolve this, but we don't want to turn them into enemies. That would be just stupid.
We don't want them either going, well, if this is the big important thing, borders are what's important to Trump, maybe we just turned a blind eye, especially in Mexico, where maybe, you know, look, and I don't say this lightly, if I'm the president of Mexico, my retort to him would be, well, fine, I'll just start pushing everybody to your border. We'll do nothing, and we'll be the conduit to get people from the rest of South America up here and right to your doorstep. That, to me, is the leverage that Mexico has.
Yeah, they do. And then, obviously, the perception of this gets rolled, you know, rolls over with the facts are. And the facts are that lately,
what are those?
The border, you know, the border is, it's not perfect. It's not perfect, but it's way better than it was, right? And part of that was Mexico. Part of that was the Biden administration. But, you know, people still think it's a mess and there will still, you know, need to do some stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not like Mexico had not taken some steps. But you're right. I mean, if they want to turn the spigot on and really, you know, irk Trump in the United States, it's within Mexico's power to do that. There's no question about it.
Yeah, because it's one thing that we use our leverage, you know, to get what we want. They kind of have a little bit of leverage as well. And this is where I don't have much faith in Mr. Art of the Deal. So overall, I mean, because we're seeing kind of, I don't know if this is a policy or if this is just a mentality of we're going to blow everything up and see where the pieces land. But what are we expecting in the first couple of days? Because he's going to be dictator on day one, he says, for that day. I don't know what's going to come out of that. But for the first 100 days, what kind of policy are you expecting? Are you hearing? What can we be paying attention to?
Yeah, well, I know, you know, more broadly that it seems like the congressional Republicans have settled on some, you know, the budget reconciliation process right away to do some tax energy deregulation stuff, right? That seems pretty clear. And then later to do some budget cutting stuff, but to do a couple of rounds of that. But I don't know, but I believe, and I'm just going to stick to the issues that I know, Rick, that, you know, on the first day or soon after the first day, that you'll see a lot of these increased tariff processes put into place. And it is a boat full of acronyms and jargon and sections that they can utilize, and no one knows which ones they're going to be. But, you know, all of them have this deliberate process where you announce it, you have a review, and then you put the tariffs into place, generally speaking. And so I fully expect that we'll see that with China, that we might see that related to some of the, you know, the fentanyl and the immigration stuff that he talked about with Mexico and Canada, and then perhaps the broader tariffs of 10 to 20%. But I think, you know, it's not like you're going to see those tariffs kick into place right away. But I suspect that you'll see the paper that will get the processes started on those very, very quickly.
Well, it'll give us a lot to talk about as they're doing it. And obviously, you guys pay attention to this stuff. So lots to focus on in the new year. Scott, as always, appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick. Great to be on.
Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Good policy, good use of our leverage, or more of the what I think is the same, figuring out how to line the pockets. Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1833. That was the day that prominent abolitionists convened in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to found the American Anti-Slavery Society. They drew up a constitution demanding an immediate end to slavery. They also demanded full civil rights for people of color. These activists distinguished themselves from the American Colonization Society, which advocated repatriation of free blacks to Liberia. Coming off the heels of the Nat Turner Rebellion in 1831, much of the society's work consisted of organizing petitions, meetings, and lecture tours. These activities emphasized slavery's brutality and inhumanity and its immoral nature. They also printed and distributed anti-slavery literature like the National Anti-Slavery Standard newspaper. The society claimed 250,000 members by 1840. They formed 2,000 local chapters and published 20 journals. Founders included prominent abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison, Arthur and Lewis Tappan, Theodore Weld, and many Quakers and free blacks. Fiery orators like Frederick Douglass and the Grimke sisters soon emerged as key leaders. These anti-slavery fighters endured mob violence, including riots and even murder, like that of Elijah Lovejoy in 1837. The society split in 1840. Garrison condemned the U.S. Constitution for its denial of freedom to African Americans. He and his supporters pushed for secession from the South if they would not abolish slavery. They also promoted women into leadership positions. More conservative elements considered this too radical. They split to form the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society. Despite this, the abolitionist movement grew exponentially. Anti-slavery ideas gained traction in new political parties.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So the reality is the next 4 years are going to be a wholesale hijacking of everything that is our government. Everything that they can privatize, profitize, and, well, hand off to their billionaire buddies, you know they're going to do. And look, they've told you. They've been very clear in their policies over the years. When conservatives have control, what do? Nothing that helps working people. And we know that there are going to be massive tax cuts. That's going to be the first agenda. And to pay for those tax cuts, well, we're going to have to literally take food out of the mouths of children. We're going to have to let granny freeze to death in the wintertime. We are going to destroy what is left of any social safety net. And oh, by the way, Doge Boy and Utah Senator Mike Lee, they're ready to destroy Social Security. So all my red hat friends who donned the red cap, who are collecting Social Security, they may not come for you, but they're coming for your children and your grandchildren. And when it happens, they are going to look to you as the generation that did it to them. It's not going to affect you. Look, they're smart. They know how to play this. We're just going to push it off down the road a little bit. You'll have time to prepare. It's what they've done with all of these programs. I think back to my grandparents. And in retirement, they had the ability to lead a dignified final chapter of their lives. They didn't have to make choices for Medicare. They had one Medicare plan. Bought a supplement to pick up all the small number of incidentals that weren't covered. Seemed like a great system. I was advocating at the time that we not have to get them to pick up the supplement, that we have Medicare that gets people what they need when they need it so that they can have a dignified final chapter. But we had corporate masters who drove us in a different direction. We had a corporate-controlled right-wing media telling us, no, skin in the game. And now that people are getting a little older, a little bit more odd on with time, they're starting to see that, you know, maybe I'm not going to get what I thought we were going to get. And it's interesting that, you know, Alex talks about the system. We talked with Alex Lawson in the last half hour. And as he points out, you know, the system is set up to ensure that there's an excuse for you being denied. There's a system set up so that that excuse is on your shoulders. Well, you made the choice. And what's interesting to me, and this has been the mastery of what right-wing politicians have been getting away with, they've been doing it under the guise of government. So our corporate masters have bought the best democracy money can buy, who have put obstacles and roadblocks in our way to get the things that we need to get done. And then they say, well, you know, it's government who did this. You know, the thing I was talking about Dave Ramsey. You know, say, well, you know, it's a government program, so let's start there. It's a government program that was set up where conservatives put in place asset tests, means tests, roadblocks, obstacles, paperwork, all kinds of systems that the average working class person doesn't have the ability to navigate. Doesn't have the time, the patience. So what they do is they throw up their hands. Oh, the government bureaucracy. Let's hand it to a corporation. And what does a corporation do? They make it easy for you to sign up, just impossible to get what you need. And I've heard this story time and time again with these Medicare Advantage plans. The problem is, and here's the problem, these Medicare Advantage plans have a lot of moneyed interest in shoving this down our throats. They've got a lot of moneyed interest in making sure that we privatize this one little thing that working people can rely on their golden years. And they're taking it. They're stealing it right out from under us. And they're doing it with a handful of trinkets. Hey, you can get gym memberships. You can get a pair of sneakers. And we're evidently, some of us are buying it. We used to call that a con. Now we call it government policy. And it's easy to be angry at government because they're not fighting back. They don't have an entire right-wing media structure. They don't have a channel like Fox to defend themselves. They're the easy target. They're the proverbial dog that gets kicked. And who wins? Well, the people who have set up these systems. Because it's easy. You go, well, you know, well, you made the choice. Sorry, your loved one's going to die. But, you know, this is what the government offered you. You made the choice. It's on you and them. And who walks away? Who walks away? The corporations and the moneyed interests. So for me, the idea of the next 4 years is to watch all the things they steal from us, and they're going to. We're going to privatize, profitize virtually everything. Everything that's left of the commons going to be in the hands of some corporate interest with a profit motive at heart. Be it education, be it more healthcare, you name it. Question is what do we do about it on the other end? Is this a rallying cry? Is this a point to go, hey, maybe, I don't know, maybe we do something to fight back. And maybe that's what 2026 is going to be about. But I'm telling you, I've had so many people say, well, I'm not paying attention. I'm dropping out. I'm not watching the news. I'm not doing any of this. Wrong. Now is the time to be hyper-engaged. Now is the time to pay more attention because this is the most dangerous part. When they know you're not paying attention, they're really going to rob us blind. want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast as always. And thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm